This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. If you've seen The Martian, you know that one of astronaut Mark Watney's chores on the red planet is dusting off the solar panels. You wouldn't want that infamous Martian dust to switch off the lights or power down the rover, right? Well, why not have the panels just clean themselves? There's another surface like this that's notoriously dust-free, and we all have them right there in our heads. It's our eyeballs. Turns out that the curve of your eyelash does a really good job deflecting air currents that might be propelling dust toward your eye. The next guest here has studied the eyelashes of all sorts of animals at the zoo and put eyelashes in a wind tunnel, too. He says engineers might have a thing or two to learn about how nature uses hair. David Hu is an associate professor of mechanical engineering and biology at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. He joins us today from Georgia Public Broadcasting. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Hu.
Hi, John. Great to be here.
And if you've got a question about the mechanics of hair, you can give us a call, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Well, okay, if we think about hair, we think about dogs and cats, not hairy bees. Tell us about the hair on bees.
Well, bee has quite a lot of hair, actually. It has 3 million hairs over its body. It has the same number of hairs as a squirrel. And just that the hairs are very small and very closely packed. And the hairs serve a very important purpose. So the bee, it makes a living by collecting pollen. And so every day it actually collects 6 times its body weight in pollen, covering its body. And so it's got to remove this pollen periodically. And to do that, what it does is it takes these arms of the bee actually are hairy too, just like the bee, and it rubs them all over its face and body. And when it does that, something miraculous happens. The hairs act like little springboards, and they actually shoot out the pollen at 1,000 times the acceleration of gravity. So when this bee's cleaning itself, it's like this miniature, there used to be this character called Pigpen in Charles Schultz comics that was just covered in this cloud of this personal bacterial cloud. But these bees actually, when they clean themselves, they use the elastic energy of these hairs to shoot off the particles at high speed.
So that's what the hairs for on bees. So it's as many hairs on the body of a bee as on a squirrel. And it's this very specialized hair that helps them stay clean.
That's right. The bee's hairs are so short and stubby, and they're spaced at the right spacing, so pollen just gets wedged between them. And so when it does this flicking motion, the hairs deflect and act like little catapults, and they just shoot off the pollen.
It's so cool. Now, some insects actually have hairy eyes, too. Seems like a strange concept to us. What can we learn from the hairy eyes of a bee?
Yes. Now the eye's interesting. It would seem to be the last place you would want a lot of hair. And their eyes are not like ours, so we actually have eyelashes that rim the eye. But the bee's eye looks like a pincushion. It has hairs just poking out like a pincushion. And the eye's a compound eye, so it has various very small eyes that see between these hairs. And what happens is when there's pollen that gathers on this compound eye, the bee can also again perform this process of rubbing its eye and cleaning itself. And these eyes also act similar to the eyelash in that, imagine this bee's flying through the air. These hairs that stick out, they create a protection zone, this stagnant zone of air, where basically particles, instead of hitting it right in the eye, would veer right before it hits the eye. So they kind of allow the bee to see but stay protected from the particles.
Now, you find eyelashes fascinating. I guess I never thought of them, but now, after reading some of your work, I find them fascinating, too. You went to the zoo to measure the eyelashes of different animals. Tell us about that.
Right. It all started when my daughter was born. And when she was born, I noticed she actually looked a lot like my father-in-law. She was really fat and totally bald and had absolutely no hair, except she had these really long eyelashes. And I got thinking, why would babies have no hair, but they just have, why do they have to have these eyelashes? So the very next day I asked my student to go to the zoo and the American Museum of Natural History, where they have a lot of these animal furs, where we could actually measure, see if any other animals besides humans had eyelashes.
Okay, and so you're looking around the animal kingdom, and it turns out that animals do have eyelashes, and they're used in more or less the same way as ours?
That's right. Almost all mammals have eyelashes, or their faces are furry. And moreover, these lashes, they're not just arbitrary length, but we measured eyelashes all the way from a mouse, armadillos, pandas, all the way up to giraffes. And we found that even though these animals didn't have very much genetic relationship, their eyelashes were all quite similar. They all had a magic length. The length of the eyelash is about one-third the width of the eye. And that's pretty much true for the 30 animals that we measured.
It's so interesting. And pretty much the eyelashes do the same thing in all these animal species. They're just all about deflecting that dirt before it gets in the eye.
Yeah, it's a different kind of filter. I mean, we usually, for example, in your studio, you probably have an air conditioning or heating system where you have a filter, which is a RAM filter. That fluid hits it, the particles hit this porous surface, and the particles get caught. And the problem with those filters is that you actually have to replace them. Now, the eyelash basically is a new kind of filter that basically just changes the airflow in such a subtle way you can't even feel it on your face, but it changed the airflow so that you get half the deposition of particles than you would if you didn't have eyelashes. So over a lifetime, that means you'll blink half as often. You'll get half of those worrisome particles in your eye. And you get all this for free. It's just when you walk forward, the eyelashes are there, and they change the flow of the air.
Well, we've been talking about eyelashes, which are, of course, now fascinating to me, and hair on bees. But what about hair on dogs and cats? I mean, how do other animals use their hair? Because you've learned a lot about all these species.
There's a lot of animals with hair, and a lot of some of these most interesting animals are hairs that are so small that you can't even see. So when we were reading papers in our article, we found that there's even some hair that can act as a bactericide that can actually kill bacteria on contact. These are the wings of cicadas. So the cicadas actually have hairs that are nanometer in diameter. So they're 1,000 times smaller than the bee hairs. So small, the cicada wing looks like it's shiny. But these nanometer scale hairs, they actually act like small pincushions. So when bacteria lands on them, they stretch the bacteria and they cause it to get really thin in some places. So the bacteria actually explodes, just like a water balloon.
That's so fascinating. So one thing about hair on animals is it's obviously there to protect them and it's there to keep them clean. But then, our dog goes outside and tracks in all sorts of dirt. It seems as though dogs can still get pretty filthy even with this protective layer of hair. How does that happen?
So the principles that we find, most of the benefits of hair are basically for small animals. So these insects like the bees, the cicada, these small animals really are good at getting rid of particles. And we think that the bigger the animals are, so the less sensitive it is. I mean, it has special hairs around its eyes. But you're right, a dog, a cat, pollen and other things won't make as much of a difference to them. So, for example, these hairs can be a danger too for them. So for these large animals, the hairs provide just a tremendous surface area they have to get clean. You might wonder why your pets never seem to get clean. Well, if you actually count the number of hairs on a cat, which we did, and figure out the surface area. So a cat actually has a surface area of a ping pong table. So that's basically all the little crevices that dirt, fleas, ticks, pollen, dust, it can aggregate. So to clean a cat is equivalent to cleaning this huge ping pong table. And a beaver has a surface area of a hockey rink.
Oh, my goodness.
Beavers actually, they have special hairs that actually are so tightly spaced that air doesn't escape from them when they go diving. So when a beaver goes diving, it's actually encapsulated in a layer of air, and water doesn't actually touch its skin. It has all those hairs, it also has a lot of place to clean. So when a beaver is grooming itself, it's like it's taking one of those devices and cleaning the ice hockey rink.
Can I just ask you a very practical question, Doctor? How do you count all the hairs on a cat?
How do you count all the hairs on a cat? The best way is to realize that they actually are pretty uniform. So most of the cat has a uniform density of hairs. So what we do is we find small patches of hair and count the number of hairs per centimeter squared, and then we just multiply that by the surface area of the cat, which is modeled like a Coke can.
Okay, so it's not as difficult as it sounds. You mentioned the story about your daughter, and it seems as though you find inspiration all over the world for some of the things that you study. And you've been on the program before talking about some of these interesting lines of inquiry. What are some secrets beyond the hair on animals that you're trying to think about right now that you want to study?
You know, I think in our daily lives we're just surrounded by all these mysteries. One of the things that we're going to go to this fluid mechanics conference in Boston in 2 weeks, where we're going to meet with all the fluid dynamicists all around the world, and some of the things we're going to talk about is one of them is how long does it take to defecate, maybe you've heard, but we've measured the urination times of various animals, and we've done the same thing for animals that defecate. And we find that defecation is only made possible by a thin layer of oil that is in your large intestine. And without that, it would be really, really hard. And a lot of these animals, when they have this special layer, it doesn't matter if you're human, or you basically are defecating your lunch, or an elephant when you're defecating 40 pounds of lunch, you don't have to stay there for 40 times more time. That this layer of oil is basically makes it a really good flow, sort of solid dispensing system.
You've left us with quite an image there, Doctor. I want to thank you for that. David Hu is Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering and Biology at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on the show, John.
When we come back, can gene therapy regrow cells in the inner ear and switch on hearing? Stay with us. This is Science Friday, and I'm John Dankosky. All right, I'm going to ask you a weird question. How old are your ears? And no, I'm not talking about how long they've been sticking out there on the side of your head. I mean, what hearing age are they? How well can they pick up sounds at different frequencies? Sounds like this. Our friends over at WNYC's Only Human podcast have been quizzing their listeners to find out. Mary Harris is here to fill us in. She's the host and managing editor of Only Human. She joins us here in our New York studios. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
So you've been polling your audience on their hearing age. What have you found so far?
Well, so they can download an app. It's called Mimi. If you go to onlyhuman.org/listenup, you can see all about it. And you take this test, which is basically like the hearing test you might have gotten in school. But it's really, really fun. I was a little bit worried. A lot of people have actually emailed me saying, oh my gosh, I'm scared to take it. I don't want to know what my hearing age is. But it takes you through a test, and it gives you at the end, it compares your score to other people from audiology tests from decades and decades, and gives you a hearing age of how old are your ears. So my ears, shocking, I was so nervous, they were 18.
Really?
So 20
you got
years
really
younger
good.
Than me.
That's amazing. See, I took the test in a really loud room, and I scored way at the bottom of my age range. And then I took it in a quiet room, and I scored at the top. So I'm feeling a little bit better about myself, but I worry about too much rock and roll has dimmed it a little bit.
Yeah, that's kind of the worry, isn't it?
Yeah. So a lot of people are taking this test. I mean, are you finding anything about this?
So what's interesting is that we wanted to offer this because so few people get tested. And we're finding that's really true. When we ask people at the end, have you been tested? Have you gotten your hearing tested? Only a third of people have. And even if their hearing is worrying them, only 43% of those people have been tested. So that's kind of alarming.
Yeah. You've been doing a whole series on hearing beyond just taking this poll. And you introduced us in one of your stories to a deaf composer named Jay Zimmerman. Tell us a bit of Jay's story.
So Jay Allen Zimmerman is a composer. He wasn't always deaf. He kind of came to New York with this dream of he was going to, you know, be the next great composer, write for musicals, write for movies. And he did that. And then he had this realization that he was losing just a little bit of hearing at the top of his range. And he didn't quite know what to do about it.
Yeah, we have a clip, actually, about that moment when Jay realized that his hearing was fading.
Then we wanted to start the track with the sound of these birds. And so the engineer found different bird sounds or whatever, puts them in the track. And I'm like, where are the birds? turn up the birds. And that's when I realized, uh-oh, because he's like, they're playing.
And you can hear the kind of panic in his voice from remembering that moment.
Yeah. And so the thing was, it started off with just losing a little bit of his hearing, and then it got much more profound. And he had to really make a decision. What am I going to do with my life? Because his whole world is based on sound and audio and the richness of that. He talks about how much he misses the tiny little tambourines and triangles. And he decided to soldier through and keep composing music. And he's come up with all these interesting workarounds to keep doing that. He has an audio visualizer. So if he has someone sing for him, he can see that they're hitting the notes. And it's kind of amazing.
Did he consider any sort of treatment?
So he did, but he decided something like a cochlear implant, which was the perfect thing for him, wasn't what he wanted. He wanted to preserve the rich experience of music that he'd always had. And he really worried that if he got a cochlear implant, that might go away.
And he actually gave you this comparison about how cochlear implants might affect the ability to hear things like music. Let's listen again.
I think your listeners have to realize that any treatment for hearing loss is not remotely like getting glasses for your eyes. It's not regular hearing again. It's an altered reality.
And you actually present a bit of sound that kind of mimics what you might hear. It's clearly audible music, but it really doesn't sound like the type of music that Jay's used to listening to.
Yeah, it sounds digitized because the cochlear implant, it sort of rewires how you hear things and it allows you to hear voices. But Jay made this really painful choice. He decided not to hear his child's voice because the music was so important to him.
Now, Jay was at a meeting for people with hearing loss when he heard about a potential new treatment, a type of gene therapy aimed at growing back cells in the inner ear and hopefully restoring some hearing. The person he heard speaking at that meeting was Dr. Lawrence Lustig. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Otolaryngology at Columbia University Medical Center and New York Presbyterian Hospital here in New York. And welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Lustig.
It's great to be here. Thanks a lot, John.
I'd like to bring on another guest as well who's also investigating a genetic treatment of a different kind, Dr. Jeffrey Holt, an associate professor in the Department of Otolaryngology at Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And welcome to the show, Dr. Holt.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I want to turn to you first, Dr. Lustig. One of the interesting things is that even though humans can't regenerate our hearing cells, other animals can. And what can we learn from that?
Well, it was known for years that birds can regenerate their hair cells. It was discovered in a series of experiments over a decade ago. And it's really taken us a long time to figure out all the molecular steps that occur to allow us to sort of rewire what we do to our own inner ear to allow us to regrow hair cells in mammals.
So tell us about how your treatment is supposed to work.
Well, what we do is we take advantage of some recent research discoveries that happened around the mid to early 2000s, where it's discovered that a particular gene called the atonal gene, which was originally discovered in the fruit fly, that if you made a mouse that didn't produce that particular gene, the mice were completely normal in every single respect, except they didn't make these critical hair cells, the cells that we use to sense hearing and balance. Then in another series of studies that happened at the university, initially at the University of Michigan, they took a virus that was loaded with that same gene. It's called the atonal gene. And they put it back into the mouse. And the mice, lo and behold, grew new hair cells. And if you deafened those mice and then added this gene back in on the virus backbone, the mice were able to regain some hearing. And then Dr. Heinrich Stecker from the University of Kansas did essentially the same studies looking at the vestibular system and also showed that if you wipe out the vestibular, you can then regrow some of those hair cells and also get some functional balance recovery back in those animals as well. And those happened around 2005 to 2007, those studies. And it's taken us this long now, with the help of Novartis, to now finally apply that in humans.
If you have questions about treatments for hearing loss, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. So, Dr. Holt, the treatment that Dr. Lustig is talking about is meant for people with acquired hearing loss, like Jay, who we heard about before. You're developing a gene therapy for people with genetic hearing loss. What can you tell us about that?
That's right. We think there are about 70 to 80 genes that, when mutated, can cause deafness in humans. About 1 in 1,000 babies are born with hearing loss, and we think about half of those are due to genetic causes. So unlike Dr. Lustig's approach, what we're trying to do is to repair the broken genes. So genes that are carrying a mutation leading to hearing loss. Our strategy is to use similar viral vectors and then use those vectors, inject them into the ears of patients with genetic hearing loss to attempt to reintroduce the correct DNA sequence and restore auditory function.
So how similar, how different is it from the treatment that Dr. Lustig is talking about?
Well, what we're doing is really trying to fix cells that are broken. These are the sensory cells that are not functioning properly, and if we can introduce the correct DNA sequence, we can make those cells functional again. We've demonstrated that with one gene in particular called TMC1, and it works quite well for that gene. Now we're trying to tackle some of the other forms of genetic deafness.
So we've heard about these couple different treatments that are out there. And Mary, I want to turn back to Jay, who you profile, and his dilemma about whether or not to get treatment. Your team gave him a recorder, and he recorded some diary entries, including this.
I have to decide what I want in this case. In this case, the world would prefer I was hearing, I think. You know, it would make it easier on everybody around me. I don't know how to process that, because I've always wanted my hearing back, primarily so I could enjoy music, which I guess makes me selfish, rather than thinking about other people in my life. But the sounds of flutes and piccolos and birds and tiny little triangles, oh, they were so gorgeous.
So Mary, he clearly wants to be able to hear again. But tell us about his decision, what he decided to do. Did he go through this gene therapy treatment?
Well, he really decided to wait. And you can kind of understand it's early days for these treatments. And the other thing I think it gets to is when you're a person with an illness like deafness, and some people wouldn't even call it an illness, you adjust. Your life becomes something new. And he's really in a great place. He has adjusted to being a deaf person. He's known as a deaf composer, and his life is going well, so he doesn't really want to disrupt it unless he knows this is the thing that's going to absolutely solve it.
And is he worried at all about risks of having this therapy?
I think so. But I think for him the timing wasn't right. He wants to wait a little bit longer.
Dr. Lustig, are there risks for this type of gene therapy, maybe for people who have very little bit of hearing left, like Jay Zimmerman?
You know, there's always a potential risk. The approach that we use to inject the virus is something that we actually do routinely in the operating room for patients who have, say, a fixed stapes bone and they can't hear as a result of that. We put the patient to sleep. We raise the eardrum up like a little window shade. We make a laser opening to the inner ear and very slowly over a couple minutes infuse the virus with the gene. And then we put a little fat plug in it. The whole thing takes under an hour. It's very simple, but even the simplest operations have potential risks, and losing residual hearing is one of them. Fortunately, we really haven't seen that in the trial to date, and it appears to be really quite safe. But like I said, you know, we've got a very limited number of patients that we've enrolled so far, partly because most patients who have Jay's level of hearing have already gone cochlear implantation. And the way the study is designed at present, those patients currently aren't candidates.
And Dr. Holt, for someone who is born deaf, I imagine the risks associated with any treatment might be somewhat different, right?
Sure. That's going to be a different set of risks. There's not the risk of losing hearing in that case. There might be some other risks associated with it, but I think those are minimal. We know that these viral vectors have already been demonstrated safe in humans, and so there's little concern about that. One of the other advantages of treating the ear with gene therapy is that it's an enclosed, fluid-filled space. So anything we inject into the inner ear, we think will stay there and not cause systemic side effects.
I'm wondering, Dr. Lustig, if there is any differences in the risks for gene therapy from what one might have with a cochlear implant, say, something else that Jay considered?
Well, you know, first of all, I'd like to say Jay was right on in terms of his concerns about an implant and his ability to appreciate music. Implants are fantastic with regard to spoken language and speech, talking one-on-one, but they really just don't work that well with music. It's a higher order listening task that we have. And implants, while they're great for language and speech. They're just not that good for music. And someone like Jay, who really his whole career is relying on music appreciation, an implant may not be the way to go. So from that standpoint, I think if we could regrow the hair cells of the inner ear of the humans, there's no question that the hearing would be better than it would with an implant. And that's why I think those of us that are involved in the study, the three sites that are involved, Kansas, Johns Hopkins, and Columbia, we're really excited about this. It's the first time this has been tried in the ear, and we can demonstrate very clearly that in animals we can regain hearing. But what an animal can't tell you is what the sound is that they're hearing. And only a human can tell us that. And that's why this study is so important and so exciting.
I'm John Dankosky. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm going to go to the phone. David is calling from Hammond, New York. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi there, guys. My question is regarding tinnitus. I've had it since age 12, and I know I recently heard some advertising on commercial radio about some kind of miracle drops or pills you can take. My doctor prescribed something. I can't remember the name of it now, but I believe it started with a C. But when I got it home and looked at the all of the precautions, it said this could lead to suicide. So is there anything out there that's safe to take without any weird side effects?
My goodness, Dr. Lustig?
Do you have about an hour to talk about this? Tinnitus is one of those really challenging problems. There are a number of different treatments. Unfortunately, there is no magic red pill that's going to make it go away. Part of it is because, you know, we have lots of people with tinnitus with hearing loss, but we have many patients with tinnitus without hearing loss and many patients with hearing loss without tinnitus. So we really don't have a great understanding of what the nature of tinnitus is and in some cases where it even resides. There's a large body of evidence that shows that it starts in the ear but then sets up in the brainstem. There are a number of different treatments that have been tried that seem to work for individuals, but when you do a blinded study with a placebo control, nothing really seems to work. The good news is there's a lot of research in this area and a number of new chemical compounds that seem to be coming out on the market over the next couple of years that we're hopeful will help people with chronic tinnitus.
Mary, one of the interesting things about hearing is it doesn't really just stop at the ears. It's a brain phenomenon, too, and it could be involved in overall brain health. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so we're going to do a story in a few weeks about this researcher named Nina Kraus out of Northwestern University, and she looks at how the brain processes sound. And what she's found is that when you look at how the brain perceives sound, it can tell you all sorts of things about the person you're looking at. So, for instance, she can give three-year-olds something she's calling a CABR. It's an EEG. And she says she can predict reading difficulties just by looking at how the brain is looking at sound. And it seems strange when you think of it on its face, but then you think a little deeper when you're looking at the page. If you don't recognize the word there, if you haven't been hearing that word, it makes it much more difficult for you to read. And she's done fascinating work looking at dyslexia and whether you can treat it by treating hearing.
Yeah, and also looking at things like dementia and how it plays into dementia or Alzheimer's.
Yeah, so there's some really interesting research at Johns Hopkins tying together whether untreated hearing loss may be somehow linked with Alzheimer's. And it's very early days, very hard to tell what the chicken and egg is here with this story, but it's fascinating. The researcher now is going to try whether he can see if treating the hearing loss can stave off the Alzheimer's, because so many people just aren't getting the hearing aids and treating their hearing loss.
Dr. Holt, before we run out of time, with your approach to treating genetic hearing loss, would you need to develop custom therapies for each type of genetic hearing loss to fix all these various mutations? I mean, how would this work?
Yeah, unfortunately, hearing loss is a multifactorial problem, meaning it can arise from many different sources. And I think that each particular source is going to require its own precision medicine sort of treatment to intervene. So what we've got is a platform for delivering genes into the inner ear, and now we need to really look at them one at a time to see which ones are going to be amenable to intervention, gene therapy interventions. Some of them will be, but some of them may not be.
Mm. Jeffrey Holt is an associate professor in the Department of Otolaryngology at Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Thank you so much for your time. I also want to thank Dr. Lawrence Lustig, professor and chair of the Department of Otolaryngology at Columbia University Medical Center and New York Presbyterian Hospital, and Mary Harris, the host and managing editor of WNYC's Only Human podcast. Thanks so much, Mary.
Thank you.
When we return, the dramatic side of weather. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. weather. Most of the time, it's in the background of our lives. It's the sequence of sun and cloud icons in a smartphone app or the voice on the radio reminding us to grab an umbrella on the way out the door. If you ever need a safe conversation topic, of course, you can always turn to the weather. But weather also has a dramatic side. Just ask the lightning strike victim whose shoes exploded off his feet when a bolt of lightning struck his body, or the cemetery manager who saw 1,000-pound vaults knocked down by Hurricane Irene. Ask the researcher who watched Chile's Atacama Desert burst into bloom after 7 dry years. Those are just a few of the stories that Lauren Redness tells us in her beautiful new book about the weather called Thunder and Lightning. It doesn't look like your average science book, and Redness is not your average science writer. She's also an artist. In Thunder and Lightning, text and meticulous illustrations combine to tell the story of how weather works and the often strange ways in which it shapes our lives. Lauren Redness joins me in our New York studio. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you so much.
And if you have thoughts about the weather, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. I know you spoke to Ira a few years ago about your graphic biography of the Curies called Radioactive. How did you make this pivot to write about the weather?
Well, they are actually connected. When I finished that book, Radioactive, for which I had to learn a lot of what was for me difficult physics, I was talking with a friend and I said to him, oh, you know, I'm burnt out. My next book is going to be about clowns and rainbows. And I was kidding, but then I started to think about that. And I was actually outside at the time, and I was looking up at the sky and watching the clouds move in this kind of spectacular panorama that unfolds before our eyes every day that we tend to take for granted. And I was thinking, you know, clouds and rainbows, they're humidity and temperature and sunlight. So they're weather, and what affects us more universally than weather?
And this book it has a unique look. Before I talk about the stories in the book, maybe you can describe the book to people, because it's not a textbook and it's not like a normal novel. It's a very large format book and has the most beautiful illustrations. Tell us about how it's different than a normal science book you might pick up.
Right. So I write nonfiction books that happen to be visual books. You might at first mistake this for a coffee table book. So there is a lot of science in this book, and that's essential to what I'm trying to do. But the science is always interwoven with human stories, with the artwork, as you describe. Most of the time, almost every page of the book, when you open it up is a full spread of artwork, because the weather is sensual, right? We feel the breeze on our cheeks, or we smell the earth after it rains. We see and even hear the way the landscape is when it's blanketed by snow. And I wanted to create that immersive, emotional experience with this book.
So tell us where you got the stories from. Where'd they come from?
Oh, all over. I did a lot of reporting. I traveled to the Arctic and to the Atacama Desert, as you mentioned, up to Newfoundland, to the foggiest place on Earth. I went to the National Weather Service. So I just talked to a lot of people. I read a lot and I traveled.
One of the places in the book that I wanted to talk about, it's fascinating. It's a collection of Arctic islands called Svalbard. What's so special about this place? Tell us.
Well, Svalbard is just south of the North Pole. It's a very cold place where they have built what's called the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. And this is essentially a huge freezer dug into the side of the mountain. And it's where all countries from around the world send their seeds to be stored in case of climate change or war or extreme weather, mismanagement. We've seen in recent years local seed banks, because most places do have a local seed bank, but local seed banks in Iraq and in Afghanistan destroyed or looted during the uprisings there.
So this is where the seeds are kept, and the people who keep the seeds there are actually, they have their own amazing story too. I mean, why would you go to this island out in the middle of nowhere that's so cold?
That's exactly right. So I went there to visit the Global Seed Vault, but I actually found this bigger story, which is about the people of Svalbard and about this place where the cold, which makes it such a challenging place to live, also creates this kind of land of opportunity where time is almost frozen itself. So the seeds hang in suspended animation in the vault, but also because of the particularities of the laws of Svalbard, where you don't need a visa to live or work and the taxes are extremely low, people from all around the world, 44 countries are represented in a population of only 2,000 people, come to earn money. And so they put their lives back home on hold. They travel to Svalbard. They live for usually about 6 or 7 years, and then they return to their homelands.
So to me, it seemed like this amazing kind of echo between the suspended animation in the vault and also in these people's lives.
And some of these people come from very warm weather places, and they want to continue living like and eating like warm weather people in a place where this is very inhospitable to growing things.
That's exactly right. I interviewed a woman named Tan Young, who's from Thailand, and back home she lives in this lush river valley. She has a farm where she grows mangoes and papayas and jackfruit, all of these luscious things. And she has moved to Svalbard to earn what she says 5 times more than she can earn back home. And so she says, I don't care about the, you know, these difficult circumstances. I just think about work. But as you mentioned, she doesn't like Norwegian food. So her family sends her seeds from back home so she can continue to cook Thai dishes. So just, you know, a mile from the seed vault, here's this person also preserving exotic seeds in the middle of the barren Arctic.
We're talking about this amazing book called Thunder and Lightning with artist and author Lauren Redness here on Science Friday. Quickly before we move away from Svalbard, what was the cold like for you?
Oh, well, at one point I was driving a dog sled and it was an absolutely beautiful moment because I was there in February, and that's a period when the island is experiencing what they call the polar night, where the sun does not rays above the horizon, so you get barely any light. And you just, at this particular moment that I was there, you get kind of a vague twilight for a few hours in the afternoon. And so it was that beautiful blue. And I wanted to take some photographs, so I took off my glove and I took some pictures. And I thought, oh, wow, that wasn't that cold. And as I put my glove back on, my hand started to tingle and tingle. I realized it had been immediately numbed.
So it's a cold, cold place. Now, on the other side of the world, you visited the Atacama Desert, which we talked about, which you call an absolute desert. What exactly is an absolute desert?
Right. So what happens in the Atacama is the desert is surrounded or is flanked by two mountain ranges. You have a coastal range on the west and the Andes on the east. And so you have what's called a rain shadow effect, where the warm, humid air is trapped on the eastern slope of the Andes and precipitates out before it's able to reach the core of the Atacama. And then on the other side, you have the Pacific's Humboldt Current creating what's called an inversion layer, and that also prevents the moisture from reaching the interior. So as one scientist put it to me, you're in the sweet spot where the summer rains can't reach and the winter rains can't reach.
So it never rains there, but then when it rains, something remarkable happens. And for people who'd never seen this place or thought about this, this just happened this year, and there was this amazing blooming. You may have seen pictures of it on the internet. It's the most fantastic thing ever.
Right. So, in fact, I read about the Atacama in a chapter called Rain, because I thought, what way could be more vivid to illustrate the kind of nourishing and dramatic powers of rain than to visit the desert, where you've so rarely seen rain, but then when you do, what happens on a periodic basis is you get these El Nino or La Nina years where the weather patterns shift and suddenly the desert can experience rain. And then the seeds that have been lying dormant in the earth spring to life. And as you say, you just get these acres and acres of beautiful, blooming, brilliant flowers spreading out in front of you.
Now, you visited so many seemingly exotic and unusual places, but you also visited the offices of the Old Farmer's Almanac. For people who maybe don't know what the almanac is, maybe you can describe it.
Right. So the almanac is one of these classic American institutions. It's actually predates the presidency of George Washington. It was it's been published for over 200 years, and they're famous for their long-range weather forecasts. And because of their publication schedule, they actually make those forecasts 2 years out, and they say what they use to create the weather forecast is a secret forecasting formula, which they keep in a black box.
Is it guarded away? Is it like the seed vault that nobody can get to?
Well, that's what I anticipated. Yeah. But when I visited their headquarters in Dublin, New Hampshire, I interviewed a longtime editor there. And I asked him, I said, have you ever seen the black vault? And he picked it right up off the floor and he handed it to me. And I was stunned.
Did you look at it? Did you figure out their secrets of how they're able to tell farmers what it's going to be like 2 years in advance?
Right. So I opened the box. He let me examine the contents, and I found the envelope marked confidential, and I read the documents, and it reads like a riddle. And I showed this to a meteorologist at the National Weather Service, and he told me, well, it's rather hard to follow. But what struck me is that revealing the secret, reading the secret, actually does nothing to destroy the mystery of their secret, because the mystery of weather forecasting, I think, is bigger than the Old Farmer's Almanac. The how elusive it is. You know, despite our scientific advances, despite our incredible technology, the ability to predict weather remains still just beyond our grasp.
Can you tell us a little bit about the art in the book and how the illustrations come together? I know that you're constantly drawing and jotting down ideas, but tell us about how you integrate it with the text that you're putting in the book.
Right. Yeah, I'm a total control freak. I mean, I do the artwork and the text and the design. I design the typeface for the book. So it's all really important to me, exactly as you say, how it comes together, because it's only in how it comes together that the reader makes meaning, really, of the content fused as one. So these images that you see are each one is kind of a composite of drawings I do from all over, and then I create a sort of drawn collage of that, and then I transform the drawing into an etching, and then I color it and add the text.
And it's somewhat like a graphic novel, but it doesn't read like a graphic novel because you drop in and out of these stories. We'll be in one place on the world, and then we'll quickly shift to another with both the text and the pictures. And it sort of presents this beautiful way of jumping to places that we would have to travel for quite some time to get to.
I hope so, yeah.
And we're talking with Lauren Redness about her book, Thunder and Lightning. And if you have questions, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. One of my favorite parts of this book is this conversation you have with long-distance swimmer Diana Nyad about wind. And we've heard her story about these long-distance swims, and we've heard her voice on public radio in the past. But what's her relationship with wind?
Right. So before she begins one of her long-distance, these open-air, open-ocean swims, she waits for a condition called the doldrums, which is the absence of wind. Because if you can imagine, naturally, wind causes waves, and waves make it very difficult to swim. So that's what she's waiting for, these glass-like waters.
Yeah, and she's talking about actually having to get up over these waves, right, with her arm. It's seemingly even just a very short wave to us when we're wading into the ocean would be a real problem for someone swimming in the middle of the ocean.
Right, right. And you can imagine after 3 days in, even. But what I loved about my conversation with Diana was that she spoke about weather and she spoke about wind, but then she brings things to almost a metaphysical level. And she talks about the melting of the polar ice cap. She talks about the things that she thinks about as she's swimming out on the open ocean, how, you know, she thinks about the animals that are swimming beneath her. She thinks about, you know, will the Earth last forever? Will the human race last forever?
I'm John Dankowski. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. You mentioned that Diana Nyad thinks a lot about the melting of the polar ice caps. Is that something you thought a lot about as you were writing this book?
Yes. I think of this book as kind of a stealth climate change book because it's not a topical book. It's not a policy book. But I address the subject of climate change, and it's woven throughout the book, and it's in nearly every chapter in some way or another.
And sometimes when we think about weather and climate being tied together, when we think about the more severe hurricanes, for instance, that began a few years ago, but we're not always thinking about these two things in an interlaced way, but you seem to really want to make that connection in your book.
Well, yeah, it seems natural to think about that connection. I mean, as you know, we experience more extreme temperatures, prolonged drought, the interconnectedness just becomes more and more apparent.
There's a lot of really interesting people stories, including a kind of a grand engineering experiment in this chapter about wind. The wind engineer for Mecca's grand mosque. So why does Mecca need a wind engineer?
Right. So this chapter about wind is also in a way about journeys. And so that's why I talk about Diana and her epic journey from Cuba to Florida. I talk about the pilgrimage to Mecca for the Hajj. And so what happens at the time of the Hajj in the Great Mosque, in the courtyard becomes its own microclimate. And it's already, you're already in Saudi Arabia in a hot climate. And then you have all of these people and the heat gets very elevated. The humidity gets very elevated. And so the government brought in these Canadian wind engineers to try to cool off this area. And so what they did was they over air conditioned the courtyard, and that cool air, when the doors are open, pours out because the cool air is heavier than the warm air, and that creates the air circulation. Mm.
Did you have personal experiences with weather that inspired you to write this book?
Well, I write about one story in the book. There's in the last chapter, which is called Forecasting, I talked to a woman who was a little girl in 1953 in Worcester, Massachusetts, right when the devastating tornado of 1953 struck. And she talks about going out with her father the next morning and looking out the window of their car and seeing the devastation. And that little girl is my mother.
Mm. And did that shape her? That always shaped who she was?
I don't know if she wants me to answer that question.
Well, on a lighter note, I will say, with just a minute or so left, you taught me something new, something I never knew about Ben Franklin. What did we learn about Ben Franklin from your book?
Well, apparently Ben Franklin, among his many eccentric qualities and fascinating qualities, he liked to sit nude by an open air for a refreshing air bath, as he called it.
A refreshing air bath. So he just liked to, basically liked to sit around naked.
Apparently.
And this is something we didn't know about. I didn't know this about Benjamin Franklin. This is what I think. Okay, so your last book was a very deep science book, and you took a break, and you decided to write a book. Okay, it's going to be about happy rainbows and clouds. What's your next project? What do you think?
I do have a project, and it also is in large part about the natural world, but it is also a contemporary story. I'm not quite ready to reveal the topic yet.
Okay. Well, I'm really pleased that you were able to bring us this book, and it is a beautiful, beautiful book. It's called Thunder and Lightning, Weather Past, Present, and Future, and the author is Lauren Redness. Thank you so much for joining us here on Science Friday.
Thank you.
You can read an excerpt from Thunder and Lightning at our website. Go to sciencefriday.com/thunderandlightning. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. When you pop an over-the-counter pain pill, do you think twice about it? One photographer wants you to. He's put drugs, both legal and illegal, under the microscope, hoping his pictures will encourage people to think more deeply about their relationship with these substances. See more at sciencefriday.com/drugpics. You can email us. The address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. Ira is back next week in New York. I'm John Dankosky.